Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all those who participated in the Battle of the Bulge from all the armies around the world in the Ardennes, Belgium, December 1944.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning out there to all of you on this wonderful couple days before Christmas. And we're here at Veterans Radio. We're going to be bringing you a program about something that's very timely. It happened 69 years ago to the day. To the day, the battle in the Ardennes, the last gasp of Hitler and his drive, to sue for peace. Ardennes, and with me is my partner, Dale Thronberry. Dale, how you doing? Hey, you did the dedication. That was cool.
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. And I want to thank all the people out there that expressed a little bit of concern about getting some kidney stones blasted this week. Everything seems to have worked out just fine and dandy. It's amazing what technology can do to you today.
And that was done at the... But you had it. Yeah, all right. Well, yeah. Anyway.
It was done at a local hospital.
Yeah, okay.
VA. But anyway, I wanted to thank everybody out there. This should be a great program for you, Bob, because this is a big, big battle for the 101st Airborne.
And that's right. And I have with me as my guest author today, John C. McManus, who will be telling us about his book, Alamo in the Ardennes. But before we do that, you know, it's a little late to be sending the Christmas packages and that now, but you can do some shopping online. Dale, why don't you tell us about that, what we have at Veterans Radio?
Well, sure, it's not too late. You know, you can go to the VeteransRadioBookstore.com.
The bookstore.
And order up your Christmas present through Amazon.com. And if you go through our website, of course, as we mentioned earlier, you have access to all of the books that we've talked about over the last 18 months, I believe. And if you click on the book, it'll take you to the Amazon website. You can order it there. Amazon still promises to get you your book by Christmas. It may cost you a little extra, but you can do that. So we want to make sure that you go through their website. You can order anything that you want through Amazon.com. If you do that, then we get a little percentage of it, and it keeps us going. So we appreciate that.
And giving a book is such a personal thing, and it's something that's, you know, candy you eat, and the tie goes hung up in the closet, but a book stays there and stays there forever.
It gets passed along, too, and which is always nice because we want to make sure that our authors get the most exposure that they can to our audiences and also to, you know, the auxiliary people that are listening out there. So, go to VeteransRadioBookstore.com, click on either the title or there's a link there that takes you straight to Amazon and pick up any book that you want. Have your credit cards all listed out, including today's book, The Alamo and the Ardennes, which will, I don't know if it's going to be up on the site yet or not,
yes,
but you can still go through there.
I thought it was up. You told me the
other
day.
Okay, well, I'm working on it.
Okay.
You know, considering the technological skills that both Bob and I have combined, it's amazing that anything gets up on the website. So we appreciate everybody's patience out there. But VeteransRadioBookstore.com, click on the Amazon, order whatever book you want. Obviously, the books that have been talked about on our program would be greatly appreciated, but it's there for you. We thought this would be a great opportunity and a great place for all of you to go because many of people ask, where do we get these books? Well, here's a place for you.
And that kind of ends Christmas anxiety. Oh, gee, I've only got 5 days. What am I going to do?
Right.
Well, that's what you do right after the program, though. Don't do it during the program.
Right,
folks.
Yeah, because we don't want you to lose your connection. I also wanted to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and the happiest of holidays from the cast and crew of Veterans Radio. I just got a text from Maria, who normally runs all of our social networking, and she is in Argentina right now, so it's amazing that she's communicating with us. But she said to make sure you follow Veterans Radio on all the social media. We are out there at Veterans Radio on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter. So if you have
and
a message,
we're podcast.
And we are podcast on the Ave Maria Radio website. If you go into there, avemaria.net, and click on podcast, scroll on down, and there's Veterans Radio, and they've got almost a year's worth of programs on there for those of you that can listen through your iPads.
iPad?
Right. Right, Nina?
Nina's.
iPads, iPods, cell phones, that we're really technologically advanced these days.
Yes, we are. Because I know that I was listening to a couple of weeks ago when I was out of town, I was listening to the program on my phone. So it's out there, folks. It's just amazing.
Nina, you would have something to say to everybody?
Well, happy holidays to one and all. But also, while we're talking about technology, Ave Maria has an app designed for iPhones, and I believe the Android version is becoming available as soon as possible. And you can listen to all our archives and all of our programs through your cell phone if necessary as well.
Right. Wow.
And all their programming.
Dale, now. Speaking of transitioning, welcoming home, people traveling in the holidays, this is a big week for all the military folks traveling. Something's going to happen on Monday. What are we going to be doing?
Oh, that. Yes.
Oh, yeah, that. That little thing called the national television.
Well, we're going to be, we've been invited to be back on Al Jazeera America television network on Monday evening between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, I think is what she said.
That's right.
To talk about welcoming home our troops and some of the things that they are going through when they come home, that their transition either back to civilian life or just being back with their families. And so we're going to be talking about some of the things that they go through, some of the out processing, I guess they would call it nowadays, that the troops go through before they come home so that they know what to look for, what to look out for, some behaviors. You got to remember, these guys, men and women, have been under a lot of stress for over a year and a half, and they're going to come home where it's really nice and calm and quiet. And so we're going to try and help them with that and help the families understand what some of these men and women might be going through.
Now, folks have asked me, well, I don't know how I get Al Jazeera. Well, here's how you do it. You go to Al Jazeera, aljazeera.com, Al Jazeera America, no.com, .net, nothing like that. It's just Al Jazeera America. When you go on their website, there's a little box that says enter in your zip code. Well, do that, and it will tell you where you can get the channel in your local area. So that'll be Al Jazeera Monday, December 23rd,
8:30 to 9 o'clock Eastern time. And they've just signed an agreement with Warner Broadcasting, I think it's called, where they've picked up another 50 or 60 markets. So there, you should be able to find them on your cable system somewhere.
Okay, well, we're going to be right back with our guest today, John C. McManus, right after this very important message.
You're listening to Veterans Radio Live on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, and find us online at AveMariaRadio.net.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
The weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Ah, yes, Teresa Brewer, Let It Snow. Well, that certainly snowed 69 years ago today. It was in the Ardennes, and that's going to be our feature today. And I'm welcoming, as our guest, John C. McManus. He's author, professor of military history at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. Professor McManus has written numerous books on World War II. He also serves as a member of the editorial board at World War II magazine. In researching this book, Alamo and the Ardennes, he traveled to the Ardennes numerous times and with the help of local guides explored the Bastogne Corridor. Professor McManus, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I know when I first saw you on the military channel did we get that thing? Okay, we had just a little bit of a technical. That's all right. When I saw you on the History Channel, I said, I've got to get this guy on because he wrote the book, Alamo and the Ardennes, all about the battle. The big decisive battle. So, folks, let me just very quickly, Market Garden, that was Montgomery's fiasco. That started back in September 1944, and that wasn't working out too well. But the Eastern Front and on the Russians, they were really pushing the Germans back, and the Germans now had to have something. They had to sue for peace. They wanted a decisive victory. John, take us from that point.
Sure. Well, of course, as you mentioned, the Germans had been hit hard by the Soviets in the east throughout the latter part of the summer of 1944, but they had kind of stabilized the line in the central Poland. And on the west, where the Allies tried Market Garden, which is basically a series of airborne drops in Holland designed to forge a bridgehead across the Rhine River, get to Berlin, and end the war. This failed, of course, but at that point, Hitler decides that he's going to launch a counteroffensive in the Ardennes, where the Germans had punched through some of the French lines in 1940, and that's one of the reasons why they've been able to conquer France, because the Ardennes forest was thinly held by the French, and once again 4 years later by the Americans. And what Hitler is hoping to accomplish with this offensive is to drive a literal wedge between the American armies and the British armies, and then force political changes, possibly in both countries, and, kind of have a reexamination of the unconditional surrender policy that the Americans and the British said they were pledged for, so that at that stage Hitler could consummate some sort of negotiated peace that would allow him eventually to turn his attention east. It's a long shot, but he's sort of anticipating the long-term problems you're going to have between the Western powers and the Soviets that become the Cold War. It's just a matter of whether they're really going to do business with Hitler.
Now, what did Hitler's generals think about? I mean, he was running the show. He sacked his commander, and he put Piper in charge, but he also... What did they think about the chance? I mean, here they were going to use all of their reserves. This was it. This was the big push. What was going on?
Right. Hitler, by this point, his relations with his generals were by and large very poor. Of course, some of them had attempted to assassinate him back in July, so that certainly didn't help trust at all. And Hitler, as you said, he's in charge, but mainly through political terror, not necessarily through the respect that many had for him, although... I'm generalizing here. Some did think highly of him still, but by and large, when he comes to, and it's a very small circle of generals who he approaches about this because it's a very hush-hush kind of thing, when he comes to most of his top generals and proposes this plan, they think he's out of his mind. They think it's a very bad idea that, as you said, they'll expend their last reserves that they can't afford. That they're far better just to hunker down defensively and bleed the Allied armies as much as they can. In retrospect, they're right, but Hitler is trying to force a political solution at a higher level. That's the entire purpose of the Bulge, is to affect the American and British political scenes.
Well, now, let's go back now to Eisenhower. He had a 1,000-mile front to defend over there on the eastern, or I should say on the western part of where the Allies were, and he had to decide who was going to be strong and who was going to be weak at what point of the Ardennes. Now, there were 500,000 Germans poised to attack, to be the spearhead on this. How did they assemble all that army supplies without anybody knowing? How did that happen?
Right, that's the question we continue to ask to this day, and the answer is multivariate. Now, you know, the Allies have Ultra, which is the ability to intercept a lot of the German communications and the coding system and figure out much of what they're doing. And obviously this is a major asset, and it's one of the great secrets of the war. But Ultra doesn't really do them any good here because the Germans don't make their arrangements via radio traffic. Hitler knew that something was insecure, and so in planning this whole thing, as I mentioned, it's very hush-hush. I mean, it's almost just done by word of mouth from Hitler to a few individuals. And so when units get orders to go to the Ardennes front, they really don't know why they're there beyond just, okay, well, an order came that we're supposed to go here. And, you know, over time, that fall of 1944, where the pace of the operations is much higher elsewhere along that long front you mentioned, you know, the Ardennes kind of slips through the cracks in the sense of capturing the attention of the Allied high command. They can't be strong everywhere. They have to be to consolidate their manpower somewhere. And the Ardennes is such that the terrain sort of defends it for you because it's a lot of hills and gorges, a very choke point oriented road net, and of course a forest too. A lot of thick multiple growth forests. So as the Germans build up on their side, you know, from a high command point of view, they're not really detecting it. It's the soldiers who sense that something's afoot with the Germans, but they don't necessarily know what.
So when it got bumped up the chain of command, what happened?
Yeah, it's a funny story. It gets bumped up the chain of command. For one thing, you know, in defense of the higher commanders, they're literally flying blind a little bit in that bad weather had grounded a lot of the photo reconnaissance missions for the Army Air Force. So that's one factor. The Germans get a break, and they had kind of counted on that. They knew the weather would go bad. But what happens is that on the ground in the Ardennes, these units that are holding what they call just a ghost sector, because nothing much is going on, they're out there patrolling, and they're sensing and seeing, in some cases, the German vehicles or hearing the German vehicles. They're sensing a larger German presence, troop presence. They're getting reports from civilians who are floating back and forth that you have a massive German buildup. And so they're sending reports up the line saying, hey, something's up. We think the Germans are going to launch an attack. And it gets like, the buck gets passed from sergeants to lieutenants to captains to colonels and to generals. And one of the things that's dysfunctional about the American command setup is that Courtney Hodges' First Army intelligence chief was not on speaking terms with General Bradley's 12th Army Group intelligence chief. They were competitors rather than cooperators. And so in this whole setup, the generals are not particularly well informed about what the Germans have in store for them. They're fixated on other things, and they don't think the Germans are capable of launching this kind of offensive. It seemed like they're on their last leg. So it's a pretty major oversight.
Folks, you're listening to Veterans Radio right here, and with me is author John C. McManus, author of Alamo in the Ardennes, the story of Bastogne and the defense in the Ardennes. That was 80,000 approximately Americans, so it looks like where Eisenhower made it a little weaker on his 1,000-mile front, he chose the Ardennes because it was a natural barrier. Is that correct?
Well, there's no question, but I would also say it's really General Bradley, Omar Bradley, who makes that actual choice. Since Eisenhower is the theater commander, he's thinking on an even higher strategic level. It's Bradley's 12th Army Group, which encompasses a large portion of the American ground armies in Europe at that time. It's Bradley who has to decide where to place his troops. And, you know, this is something that's not always that popularly appreciated, certainly on the German side, in retrospect to the war. The Americans don't have limitless reserves of manpower at all. They're kind of hurting by the fall of 1944 because they've taken terrible casualties in Normandy and in the Hürtgen Forest and wherever, the Vosges. So Bradley can't be strong everywhere, and he has to make difficult choices, and he makes what he later admits is a calculated risk. He takes this calculated risk of putting fewer troops in the Ardennes. It's about 3.5 divisions to cover more or less about a 70 to 80-mile front, which is nowhere near adequate. But he feels he has no other choice, just as the French felt the same way 4 years earlier. So Hitler is preying upon this vulnerability and this assumption that you can't maneuver armored forces in the Ardennes That'll be tough for tanks and other vehicles to move, and it is tough, but it's not necessarily 100% true. And so that's why the German offensive, one of many reasons why it's a major surprise.
Now, there was something else, and let's get back to Bradley here, that he was relying on Ultra. And when the initial attack happened on December 16th, he thought, no, this is a feint. Something else is going to happen else. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, from an operational and command point of view, in order to have access to Ultra, you needed to be an Army commander above or above. So basically like Courtney Hodges or George Patton or even at a higher level, at Army group level, Omar Bradley. So, yes, Omar Bradley, like many of the very, very senior commanders, has come to rely quite heavily upon Ultra. But Ultra is not telling him anything in relation to the offensive that's coming. Ultra is just telling them the German order of battle. But if, ironically, there's a lot of units that are unaccounted for, that they don't know if they exist or where they went or what their status is. And those are the very units that Hitler is refitting and re-equipping with some of his newest tanks and whatever else, and placing in the Ardennes and filling out with whatever he's got left of young, you know, well-fed, motivated, good combat troop material, particularly in the 6th SS Panzer Army on the northern shoulder of what will become the Battle of the Bulge. But a lot of the German army, the 500,000 to 600,000 who are waiting to strike, a lot of them were in hastily put together Volksgrenadier divisions of, you know, overage draftees or young, you know, young guys like who are 13, 14, 15 years old, teenagers they just throw into the maw. So it's the German army at that point is still a real mix and overall hurting for manpower.
Now, as far as the Americans, there was one unit that was refitting from the Battle of Hurt, and then there was another unit that had just been placed online. They had never been in combat before, only 3 days. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and this is the thing about the Ardennes sector. As I mentioned, you know, it's 3.5 divisions covering this long front. And, of course, every division, what makes them fascinating is that they have their own culture, their own story, their own kind of personality. And so at what ends up being part of the northern shoulder of the German attack, you have the 106th Infantry Division, the Golden Lions, who have been on the line all of about 3 days when the German attack comes. They had, you know, deliberately been sent by the commanders to that sector to just kind of get their feet wet, patrol, learn what the front lines are like, and ease their way into combat. Well, they don't get to ease their way in. Then farther to the south, you have the 28th Infantry Division in what I call the Bastogne Corridor. And they're basically holding this 30-mile front. And they had fought in Normandy. They had fought at the Siegfried Line. And then most recently, they had fought in the Hürtgen Forest, and the division had been more or less destroyed in the Hürtgen Forest, suffered over 6,000 casualties. So they'd been sent to the Ardennes because it was supposedly a quiet sector, so they could refit, get their nerves back in order, if ever they could, and incorporate replacements. So now here they end up taking on the crux of this German offensive in the Bastogne Corridor, and in ultimately, it's really quite remarkable because they buy time for the 101st Airborne Division to get to Bastogne and then successfully defend the town. And also another unit I should mention, kind of on the northern shoulders, the 99th Infantry Division, the Checkerboard, and they're more or less new to combat. They've been there longer than the 106th, but they're fairly new, and you know they certainly are going to be right in the way of a major part of the German offensive. So, you know, these guys have no idea what's about to hit them in that sense.
Well, it did hit them on December the 16th. What time of the morning? And boy, what happened at that point?
Yeah, December 16th is when you see this kind of violent movement of the German armies westward. And it's a mixture. In some sectors, they advance early in the morning in the darkness, but they in order to help their advance of their infantry to try and infiltrate the American lines, they beam searchlights off the clouds. Well, this is a really foolish thing for the Germans to do because it silhouettes their guys who are heading toward the American lines, and the Americans quickly get a sense of how many people are about to attack and just chew them up. In other sectors, they begin with an artillery barrage, which largely is ineffective, but is alarming to the Americans because it's so unusual, and, you know, it certainly is probably going to presage some sort of attack.
I'd like to ask this, why was that ineffective? Do you have an answer for that?
Why was the artillery barrage ineffective?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it was ineffective because the Americans were hunkered down in positions that were not quite impervious to artillery, but not quite vulnerable to them. The Americans were not on the move. That's when you're going to be most vulnerable to artillery in that circumstance. So the Americans are in heavily dug in dugouts or in buildings, in stone buildings in the various towns, with soldiers out on outpost duty or whatever, who could then just run inside the buildings once they heard the shells coming. And it's not as if the shells inflicted no damage. I wouldn't say that. Certainly it hinders American communications, the shelling does, but it does not inflict a lot of casualties upon the Americans, as the Germans would have hoped. So really, they have the most success in the areas where they just kind of infiltrate in the dark, and then all of a sudden, from an American point of view, you've got Germans right here in front of you attacking you within 20 yards in the dark. And there's confusion and all of that. So the artillery barrage just kind of gives them away, and then the searchlights certainly do. So the Germans, in some ways, don't go about this very intelligently.
I was at the 101st Airborne monthly meeting the other day, and I was talking to one trooper. I was hoping he'd be here today, but he couldn't make it. However, he was talking about that they were, when this happened in the morning on the 16th, that there were some American soldiers that were caught with their knickers down. I mean, here it comes. Here come the Germans. They had to burrow in the snow alongside the road. When he said that, I mean, I thought about that, folks. Burrow in the snow. The German patrol passed, and then he said, and he kind of lowered his head, he said, then we opened up on them. Wow. To think of that. And they had to do that kind of subterfuge in order to survive. You want to comment on that a little bit about those beginning units that held back the Germans? Tell us about that.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, those units, if you can imagine, the American front is kind of like a mirror that has been shattered. So you have these shards all over the place, and a shattered mirror is still dangerous to someone walking around, particularly without proper foot gear. Well, the Germans are almost like someone walking around without proper foot gear, because they certainly have numbers on these guys, and they've shattered the mirror, but they're constantly getting held up by these small groups that are fighting in little clumps, usually from buildings in choke point towns, and just kind of surrounded and cut off. And, you know, like you said, maybe watch the Germans walk by and then open up when you have an advantage, and then you're going to draw a major German response, and maybe tanks that will come up. All of this kind of stuff is going on. You have all of these little human dramas are playing out among various towns in the eastern part of the Ardennes, and especially in the Bastogne Corridor, to where you have Americans either fighting to the death or fighting as hard as they can until they run out of ammo, and then trying to move west and get away from the Germans, usually in small groups. Alamo in the Ardennes is just full of these stories from the 28th Infantry Division perspective of how much they wreak havoc on the German timetable, because the German offensive is designed for speed. Speed, speed, speed. You've got to move quickly before the Allies can react, before Allied air can come into play, before Allied advantages of firepower and manpower will come into play. You've got to go rapidly, if you can imagine, like northwest towards the Meuse River and into Belgium towards Antwerp. That's going to be the way you cut off the British and the Americans and force some sort of political solution to this. So all of this is always a long shot for the Germans, and every time they get held up in a little town like Weiler, or Clairvaux or Krinkelt and Rocherath, or all these little villages where you see heavy, heavy fighting, every hour costs them on the larger level of this whole offensive.
John, we're coming up on our halfway break in just a moment. We're speaking with John C. McManus, author of Alamo in the Ardennes. You can pick up that book by going to the Veterans Radio bookstore. So we'll be right back after this very important message. Don't go away.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen on live at AveMariaRadio.net.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother. My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Back here in America, we were all getting ready for Christmas. They certainly weren't out there in the Ardennes. Things were happening very quickly. With me is our guest today, John C. McManus, author of Alamo in the Ardennes. John, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, now we're December 16th, 17th. Oh, by the way, folks, if you have any question for our guest or a comment you want to make on the topic today, 877-573-7825. Once again, 877-573-7825. Okay, there they are. It's the Ardennes. American engineers are blowing up bridges. That's slowing them down. So what does that mean to Piper, who's now the commander? By the way, he was an avowed Nazi, And he was in charge of this SS group that was there to attack in the Ardennes. So what happened when Piper was coming through with his tanks? He couldn't find these bridges. What did he do?
Right. Piper is, of course, part of the Waffen-SS. He is one of the major commanders in the 1st SS Panzer Division. And his assignment is what we would often call the northern shoulder of the bulge. So it's a very important assignment to kind of knock through the American lines, knife northwest, and get to the Meuse River and across that river as soon as possible. Well, he ends up running into some pretty hard resistance, particularly by the 99th Infantry Division, but eventually by the 2nd Infantry Division, too, a veteran division that had fought since the day after D-Day, but had been at a different sector and is sent back to deal with Piper and what he's doing. And so instead of a kind of a slashing mobile campaign in which he moves in leaps of 10 to 15 miles, Piper ends up in this kind of protracted fight it out with roadblocks and fight it out in the little towns and villages battle that's really not to his advantage. Now, he's inflicting major damage, and he's capturing Americans, and he's capturing weapons and food and some level of fuel, though not as much as he needs. But the long and the short of it, from an American point of view, is that the Americans are able to parry Piper and at least hold him up enough to buy time. I mean, this early phase of the bulge is all about buying time, regardless of where you are, whether you're in the 28th Infantry Division east of Bastogne or whether you're in the 99th dealing with Piper. It's pretty much the same mission in that respect.
Now, there was a group, I'm going to try and say this right, that was called the Carcinogy, posing as Americans. Let's talk about that.
Right. Otto Skorzeny's guys.
Skorzeny, there we are.
Right. This group is basically German special operations and disinformation and intelligence groupings. And part of it is just an airborne operation of paratroopers dropped in to do what paratroopers do, to cause problems in rear areas, to capture key crossroads and all that kind of stuff. But the most famous aspect of the operation is these German soldiers who dress up as Americans in American uniforms and circulate around in and around the American lines, and especially in the rear areas, just causing problems, giving people the wrong directions, sowing panic, messing with road signs, any way they can cause issues. And, of course, it's like anything along these lines. You know, once you find out you've got spies in your midst, it tends to sow paranoia. And certainly once the American soldiers figure out that you've got Germans posing as Americans, the word spreads very quickly, and the paranoia grows very quickly. Who's legit and who isn't? You got to remember, too, a lot of the American units have been shattered. So you are retreating, and you're dealing with a lot of people you don't know. So my group has retreated from this village, and we're trying to go away from the Germans. Your group has retreated from the next village 5 miles away, and now we're mixed together in a forest someplace. Do I know whether you're really an American or not? You got a lot of issues like that.
There's a great piece of film. You see it all the time in the military channel, folks. It's black and white, and it shows a Bradley pulling up in a Jeep and a soldier stopping him and asking him for his ID. For a guy as impatient like that, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, Bradley, I think this is my opinion, but I think at that moment, Bradley is irritated and annoyed a little bit because time is of the essence, and he's got a lot of important things to deal with. But I also think Bradley being Bradley, he respects that that's the soldier's job, and he's doing it the correct way. And they've got to check everybody, even somebody like Bradley. There's major rumors sweeping that the Germans are going to punch through and get to Paris and have assassination squads go in and kill Eisenhower. So Eisenhower becomes almost a prisoner in his own headquarters to the doubling and tripling of his guard detail. So in the Ardennes, among all the Americans there, or a lot of them, there's this sense of making sure that everybody around you is on the up and up. And so, you know, you're asking the American of the day pop culture questions. Who's Rita Hayworth married to, or who won the World Series in 1940? What line on the subway runs from Brooklyn to wherever? You know, all of this kind of stuff that Americans might know.
Dale, you have something to say.
John, this is Dale just answering it. The question, you just answered my question, because I know that we've talked to a lot of survivors of the Battle of the Bulge, and one of the things that they all mentioned was that when they were on guard duty, when somebody would approach, they had to have these, as you say, pop culture questions that they needed to ask. And if you didn't know it, you just got shot, and that was the end of it. And I was thinking the same thing probably in every conflict that Americans have been involved in. We did the same thing in Vietnam, where we would ask, you know, radio frequencies up from Mickey Mantle, you know, from number 7 up to whatever it happened to be. And I just find that a fascinating story that these guys had been talking about when we had the opportunity to talk with them. And you mentioned that artillery barrage earlier on, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he was saying most of the artillery was going over them, but it was exploding in the trees, and they were getting hit with splinters more than they were with artillery.
You want to comment on that, John?
Right, tree bursts is always a major problem, if you're fighting in the forest and you've got artillery coming in. Tree bursts had been a huge issue during the Hurtgen Forest battle, especially for the 28th Infantry Division. And then in the Bulge, you're going to see it impact a lot of American units. I think most famously, tree bursts are really going to affect the 101st Airborne Division. Once they're around Bastogne, you have a neck of woodlands north of the town called the Bois Jacques, which basically means Jack's Woods. And that's where they have a lot of their fighting holes. And what's interesting is you can still go and see them today, the remnants of those holes. When the German artillery would come in, this would, of course, you know, once you've got explosions of shells in the trees, this multiplies the fragmentation effect of not just the steel splinters, but also wood splinters traveling at great velocity. This is a real issue as the Bulge unfolds. And once you're attacking through woodlands, which is the latter part of December and there forward, well, in the initial barrage on December 16th, the barrages are generally not that effective because most of the American units are not in the forest at that point. They're closer to the roads. They are overlooking waterways. They are in buildings in various villages. It's a little bit later on that the tree bursts are going to be a real issue.
Well, okay, John, there were some atrocities. We're talking about SS Waffen groups. These people were despicable, and one was with a black outfit, I believe, in Witz, if I'm saying that correctly, and the other was at Malmundi. Why don't you go ahead and comment on that a little bit?
Right. The most famous atrocity in the Battle of the Bulge, of course, is the Malmundi Massacre, which happens near what's called the Bonnier Crossroads. You have an artillery observation unit that, in the confusion, ends up bumping into one of Piper's leading task forces. So you have dozens of Americans who were captured in this small unit encounter, and eventually the Germans just set up machine guns and mow them down. Now, they don't kill all of them. Some of them are able to get away later on. And you know, so the Malmundi Massacre is very, very well documented. And, of course, some of the perpetrators will be tried and as war criminals and executed, or at least incarcerated. Piper himself will be incarcerated for several years because of this, too. Well, you know, we talked about the word spreading about Germans in American uniforms. Well, that was nothing compared to the word spreading of the Malmundi Massacre and other shootings, smaller, lower-level shootings that the Germans, mainly the SS, carried out as they advanced. So you end up with this kind of mindset in the American armies of, well, we're not taking any more SS prisoners. And then this tends to kind of conflate into, we're not taking any more prisoners, period. And it's not as if that's always the case during the Bulge, because the Bulge lasts 6 weeks, but it happens a lot.
But I want to point out to our listeners that, okay, the American soldiers now are hearing all this, they're hearing about these massacres, they're hearing about these atrocities, so they took it out on these these Americans, or these Germans that posed as American. It really kind of peed off all the Americans, wouldn't you say that?
Well, the Germans who are posing as Americans...
And they shot the guys.
They did, because they're in a different category. They're in a category of spies, because they're not wearing the uniform of their country. Most of them, just were in U.S. uniforms. I think some might have had German uniforms underneath their American uniforms, but even so, once they're apprehended, yeah, they're going to be, under the rules of war, acknowledged by both sides, they're going to be shot. But that's a different matter than... Let's say if our unit captures a village and captures 20 German army soldiers and decides to kill them, obviously that's a completely different thing. But both sides will do that, you know, although it's not the majority circumstance. Prisoners generally are taken on both sides during the Bulge.
If you have a question for our guest today, John C. McManus, author of Alamo and the Ardennes, or you want to comment on the Ardennes, please give us a call, 877-573-7825. Yep, we take care of the call, that's right. It's toll-free, 877-573-7825. Well, we're coming up on our third break, and John, start to take us to Bastogne. Things are now pulling into Bastogne. This is going to be the last hurrah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Bastogne's very important for the Germans to have within the first day or two. And the reason for that is I mentioned how, the terrain is such that you have choke point road networks and towns in the Ardennes. Well, Bastogne's seven roads go through it. And so in order to advance the way the Germans want to, they really have to have Bastogne. And this is why it's so vital for the Americans east of the town in a corridor of about 20 miles or so to hold off the Germans so that other Americans can reinforce Bastogne. It ends up as this really epic battle.
Well, we're coming up on our third break, folks. You're speaking with author John C. McManus, author of Alamo and the Ardennes. So we'll be back right after this very important message.
You're listening to Veterans Radio Live on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, and online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Looking for a job you'll really love? Well, no one gives you more career choices than the Air Force. And no matter which of our more than 150 specialties you choose, you can be satisfied knowing you're part of a team that's making a difference. Anyone can give you a job. We're building careers. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir.
Well, things are really going on over there in the Ardennes in 1944 and 1945. And every time I look at Bastogne, by the way, welcome back. Our guest today is author John C. McManus, author of Alamo in the Ardennes. You're going to want to pick that up, folks. You're going to want to go to our bookstore. Dale, why don't you tell us a little bit very quickly about that bookstore?
VeteransRadioBookstore.com. Go in there, click on the Amazon link, and go buy your books right there.
And especially this one. Boy, yes. Wow. Okay, I'm looking at Bastogne, John. Why didn't they just go around it?
Well, they should have. They don't go around it because the Germans knew from their early plans, well, we've got to have this. So they continue with that mindset, even though Bastogne doesn't have the same value for them on December 20th as it would have on December 16th, if that makes any sense. And the reason it doesn't at that point is it's become a siege. And so that's just drawing off combat power and resources from where they need it, elsewhere in the Ardennes, to fulfill their larger purpose. And the reason all this has happened is that you basically have three units that have held off the Germans long enough to save Bastogne. It's the 28th Infantry Division, Combat Command Reserve of the 9th Armored Division, and Combat Command B of the 10th Armored Division. All have fought very heavy battles, either east of Bastogne or in little towns around it, that has bought time for the 101st Airborne Division to be rushed from Mormelon all the way to Bastogne so that they're in place by December 19th and 20th, and they're part of that battle, too. But, you know, in the case of the 28th, you know, I mean, they absorb more or less the full fury of the 5th Panzer Army, which is moving toward Bastogne. And in particular, the 110th Infantry Regiment of the 28th Division is right in the middle of this hurricane. And its commander is a guy named Colonel Hurley Fuller, this dour old Texan, about 50 years old at that point, who was new in command. And he is literally on his phone to his division commander, Norman Dutch Cota, who doesn't quite have the same appreciation for how desperate the situation is. And there's tanks rolling right outside the command post, which is a hotel, a nice little hotel in a town called Clairvaux. And Fuller is telling them, basically, I'm like Colonel Travis at the Alamo, which meant something very special to Fuller as a Texan. And that's why I chose this title for the book,
Alamo in the Ardennes. Excellent title, by the way, John. I love it.
Yeah, thanks. I think it really captures what happens to these guys and what they end up doing. Just as those guys at the Alamo bought time for Sam Houston, well, these guys here in the Ardennes buy time for other American units, in this case, when we're talking about Bastogne, the 101st Airborne Division, to get in place to do what they do to ultimately thwart the German offensive. So the Germans get kind of taken in at Bastogne to this siege effort for prestige and pride to take Bastogne when it's no longer that valuable to them by the third week of December, by December 20th, 21st in particular.
Now, I was speaking to a historian the other day, and he said that one of the keys to the Germans not being able to overrun Bastogne was the fact that if you think of a perimeter, a target, and the perimeter being the 101st and other units that are defending, and in the center is Well, that the Germans would attack in units at certain specific sectors. That's what I want to get out. Instead of attacking all around the perimeter. So the Americans had the reserves in the center of this, quote, target, and they then could then respond to whatever sector that the Germans were attacking from. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's dead on right. I mean, the Germans never launch a full-scale, all-out attack on Bastogne. The Americans were always worried about it during that period from, you know, December 20th to 26th when Bastogne was cut off and more or less surrounded. Yeah, they hit at various points on the perimeter, which allows the Americans to kind of, react to wherever the crisis happens to be. General Anthony McAuliffe is commanding the 101st Airborne Division at that point, and it lets him off the hook in a way. Because remember, he's very hard-pressed. I mean, his unit is not very well-supplied going into Bastogne. And now they're operating alongside the remnants of the 28th and Combat Command B, the 10th Armored, some artillery units and engineering units. It's really an ad hoc force there. And we think of it as lines, you know, in a ring around Bastogne, but it's more like outposts that are being manned by lonely, cold soldiers who are on the lookout for the Germans and really worried they're going to come with major armored forces at any morning, any day, you know. I think that's right. It's one of the reasons why the Germans failed there. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, I think quite aptly, at that point they should have bypassed it, and it would have been a headache, certainly, but they would have been better off for that from their point of view.
Okay, it's a last-ditch effort. It's January 1, 1945. The clouds are lifted. The weather's better. The Germans have an air attack. Cover that, John.
Yeah, at that point, Hitler himself knew the momentum of the attack had waned. I mean, really, the German attack has failed by Christmas Day or the day after or so for what they have in this larger purpose, the offensive. So Hitler being Hitler, he decides on one last major gesture or counterpunch to do something. Who knows what? So he scrapes together pretty much all the air assets he has and sends them in battle against the Americans in the Bulge, because by then Allied air had really come into play. And this infuriates him that his columns are getting shot up around the roads of the Ardennes. But his air force is really not in a good position to attack. They're better at defending. And
it killed a lot of pilots, didn't it?
Yep, it did. And that's the pilots are more valuable than the planes for them at this point, especially experienced pilots, which they don't have anywhere near enough of. So they lose a lot of pilots, and in addition to many planes. I've always thought personally he would have been better off parceling those air units out into small packs of about a half a dozen to a dozen aircraft to attack the Americans at various choke points where their vehicles are on the road or their troops are fighting in villages or whatever. I think that would have been a lot more effective rather than this amass kind of aerial armada that's easy to identify and shoot out of the sky.
John, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to cover this. Piper himself, he runs out of gas, throws his hands up, and he starts walking home. What happened at that point?
Yeah, Piper is foiled within a few days after Christmas. It's pretty clear that he's not going to succeed. And he's thinking by then in terms of just trying to get out of what is potentially total destruction. Just try and get out with as many of his men and as many vehicles as he can. I mean, he's basically put his head into a noose, ultimately. So, yeah, he's able to get away. A number of troops in his command are able to get away. They lose a lot of their vehicles, of course. And as I mentioned, some of them, those who serve with or under his command, are going to be apprehended after the war and tried for the Malmedy massacre, including Piper. Piper will be incarcerated for a time, but he will be freed, I think, sometime in the early 50s. I'm not sure the exact date, but mainly through the efforts of Senator Joe McCarthy, because there was an element of thought in this country that Piper had been kind of railroaded for something that wasn't quite his fault, that he was not responsible for the massacre because he wasn't actually there and he didn't order it. So Piper will be released from prison, and he'll eventually kind of assume a different identity, become a successful businessman, and live in France until he is the local French Communist Party figured out who he was, and ultimately probably killed him. That's not, we don't know that for sure, but it's fairly clear that that's probably what happened.
I have 1 minute to give to you. You have a new book coming out, The Dead and Those About to Die. That's coming out. John, your book, tell us about that. 1 minute.
Yeah, it's called The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. And it comes out on May 6th of the next year in time for the 70th anniversary of the Norman invasion. And it's a completely new look at what Omaha Beach was like through the eyes of the 1st Infantry Division. There's a lot of new stuff in there about D-Day, and I'm very, very excited about it. So, yeah, it'll be out on May 6th. You can find a link to it on Amazon.com.
And you can buy it now, correct?
You can. You can pre-order right now either the electronic version or the hardcover, and they'll have it to you on May 6th.
Whew. Wow, what a day. What an and God bless all those that defended there in the Ardennes. And, John, I want to thank you again for being our guest on Veterans Radio, publisher and writer of many, many, many books on World War II. Would you come back to Veterans Radio?
I'd be glad to. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you again, John. God bless.
Thanks, Bob.
Boy, we could have this guy on every week.
There was one line I wanted to get to ask a question, and I know we're running out of time, and I can't see over my shoulder. But there is one famous line that comes there when the Germans ask the Americans to surrender, and it's General Anthony McAuliffe, and he sends a message back scrawled across, and it says, nuts.
I know. I wanted to ask that, too. Did he really say that?
And it had to be translated for the German general. And, anyway, nuts.
Okay, well, we'll have to think about that. Yeah, we have 20 seconds. Dale, we're going to be on Al Jazeera Monday, December 23rd, according to the producer, from 8:30 to 9 o'clock, right? Right.
Somewhere in that time period, yes.
Yes, okay.
And we'll be here next Saturday also, looking back on 2013.
Until that time, this is Bob and Dale from Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.
Merry Christmas.
Be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow. And present.